From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
That was the sound of the Mythbusters doing what they do best, blowing stuff up. In our next hour, Adam Savage and Jamie Heineman, the San Francisco-based co-hosts of the popular Discovery Channel program, join us in studio to talk about swimming in syrup, dipping their hands in molten lead, and paddling a canoe made of duct tape, all in the name of science. Forum is next. Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Well, the Mythbusters are here with us in studio for this hour. Since they're both in San Francisco, surprising it's taken us so long to get them here, but they're busy guys. San Francisco-based hosts of the Discovery Channel show, which is now in its 10th season. Both special effects experts who have served as guest editors of Popular Mechanics and present a weekly popular documentary show based on holding myths, tall tales, urban legends, and holding them, I should say, up to science. They've appeared on David Letterman, Good Morning America, The Colbert Report, NPR's Morning Edition, but now have finally made it to the big time here as guests with us on Forum. Glad to have you guys. Like I say, it's taken long enough, and I'm delighted you're here.
I'm really sorry it's taken us this long. We only work, we shoot most of our stuff in our shop. It's about 5 minutes from here.
Yeah.
Well,
you might have been able to hear us blow stuff up.
I was going to say, were you blowing something up before you came here?
No, we were actually doing a wrap up on whether boiled microwave water is actually dangerous to plants. Mm. We've had a little greenhouse experiment set up for a couple weeks.
Let's hold that, I guess. We want to keep people in suspense as to what the conclusion is. It must be a lot of fun what you do. I mean, some of it's really crazy, and I kept thinking, God, have they got Lloyd's of London, or who's doing the liability for these guys? But the truth of the matter is you seem to really, well, find it exceedingly enjoyable.
Well, as far as the insurance, it's something that we've learned our way around over the years. We have a safety consultant that we go over every story with before we do them, and that person acts as a liaison between us and the insurance company. And, you know, at this point, having done it for over 10 years, the insurance company has a certain level of trust in us.
Well, yeah, congratulations. I mean, to endure television for 10 seasons in itself is quite an achievement. And I kind of get knocked out by the backgrounds, the resumes you guys have. Now, you worked a lot in special effects and commercials and everything. I mean, Russian language, jack of all trades. I mean, working in television and film early on, in your case, Adam, I mean, it's just how broad and how diverse the ranges of what you guys have done.
Well, I think that we're both people who've tried to investigate every interest that they had. You know, I, for one, always enjoyed jobs where I was actually learning something. And when I moved from New York to San Francisco, that was no exception. I started getting into the theater industry here, which was really vibrant in the early 90s. And that led to Jamie Heineman actually calling me and asking me to come work for him in commercial special effects. And I mean, every single career that I've had, whether it's assistant animator or projectionist in a movie theater or special effects, it's always been something different every day. And that's really the best part.
Well, it's the best part of doing a talk show, too. It's something different every day. But I was struck by an article I happened to see in Wired, which you guys probably saw. It was a physics professor by the name of Red Allain. And he said, are these guys really scientists? Can you really call them scientists? And he used an example of some dialogue between people where they said, well, you know, you can't do a thumbprint scanner in an iPhone because I saw in Mythbusters. And he said, well, you know, Mythbusters prove things. And the fact is, maybe they don't prove it over and over again the way scientists do, but they are scientists. I mean, he was saying maybe you need more trials, but you're doing what human beings do, and almost all human beings, so his argument went, are scientific if they're curious and they want to find out answers.
Yeah, well, actually, that's a good point. And one of the things that we like to mention about us and whether we're scientists or not, we approach it as a way of just getting a job done. You know, we want to if we want to figure something out or find an answer to something, you know, it makes sense to be methodical about it, to do a good job of that. And the fact is that that in some sense is science.
And he praised your having methods over results and said, you know, you realize science isn't absolute, which he said was also a definite positive.
Well, and we alone among other shows, we have regularly gone back to results we've already concluded and re-experimented with them with new data and new protocols and come to different results. We are totally willing to throw out something we've concluded before if it turned out that our methodology wasn't right. We often say we don't stand by our results, but we really do want to stand by our methodologies. We want to conduct something robust, even if we're only doing it once.
We're talking with Adam Savage and Jamie Heineman, the two Mythbuster hosts who are here with us in studio, and we'll give you an opportunity not only to talk to them, but we'll have an opportunity to hear some of their work. I just wanted to mention, talk about work. I mean, you guys have really parlayed a lot of your 10-season success. Live show at the Orpheum coming up Saturday, October 2nd. Let's give it a plug at 2 and 8 o'clock, part of a 28-city sold-out tour. I want to find out more about that. But also, you did the Steve Jobs thing, iGenius. I also have an explosive exhibit going on at the Museum of Science and Industry, which is, I think, scheduled for February 2014 in Tampa. Are there going to be in other museums, by the way?
It's actually opening in Denver, Colorado, in just a few weeks.
Uh-huh.
So the museum show is traveling around the country.
And what's going to be at the Orpheum?
At the Orpheum, which I believe is actually Saturday, October 12th, if I'm not incorrect. Jamie and I wrote and have been taking a live show called the Behind the Myths Tour around the country for the last year and a half. It's about 2 hours long. We've done our best to translate Mythbusters to the stage, and we do it by messing with the audience. It's a really, really fun live show. We bring at least a dozen people up on stage during the course of the show. We pit them against each other. We challenge their assumptions. We change the way they see things, and we have a lot of fun.
Sounds like guerrilla theater a little bit. I mean, this is interactive stuff.
Huh? It's very interactive.
It is, and we had a little trepidation at first as to whether we could translate what we do on the show into a live stage thing, because obviously we can't use high explosives or high-powered weapons or anything like that. And we looked at...
No hand grenades either?
I think you mentioned
you're working with hand grenades now.
No, no explosives.
Yeah. And so what we did was, you know, try to sit back and look at what is important to us in Mythbusters. And we noticed that there's something about the playful way that we approach what we do and its connection with science. And so we thought carefully about that. And on the stage show, we try to demonstrate that playful approach and how there's actually a lot more, you know, worth to that than just having fun. It actually, you know, it's like the way a child learns is by play.
And, it's educational in the best sense. Of course, I'm old enough to remember Mr. Wizard and all those kinds of things. But, you know, you guys do it very well. And you even got President Obama to go on with you. I mean, if people didn't see that show, it was all about the idea that you can cast enough sun rays onto a ship, for example, to actually have effect on it. First of all, I want to find out, how did you manage to land Obama?
Well, the Obama administration reached out to Jamie and I to come to the White House for a policy speech he gave about the STEM initiative a few years back, which we are always plugging to say it shouldn't be STEM, it should be STEAM, because arts should be part of that training curriculum.
And we should mention STEM stands for science, technology, engineering, and math, and let's definitely put the A into that. I like that.
Absolutely. And we were there, and he gave us a shout-out. We were just talking about Mythbusters as a prime example of a show that makes science fun and engaging for kids, something we never actually set out to intend to do with the show. And after we had gone there and met him, the White House asked us if we would like to try and work with them on an episode. And we came up with the Archimedes Death Ray. We went to the White House about a year later to film with the president. And it was wonderful. He was a total pro. We actually shot all of our sequences with him in 13 minutes flat.
Wow.
And then he was back to doing the important work.
And how'd you get all those young people out there with mirrors?
Well,
it was like a fleet, a battalion. Really.
Yeah. Yeah, they were from Encinal High School in Alameda, where my wife is a science teacher. And she rallied them for us. And, you know, the thing was that that school is right near the coast there. So all we had to do was walk them from their classroom right out there. Although we did have to make a point, which was interesting. The White House required that we not do it during school times, lest there be any implication of you know.
Mythbusters taking kids out of school. Right. So we had to shoot it on a Sunday.
Yeah. So,
they took kids out of church instead.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. How many mirrors were there?
500.
Yeah, 500.
And the kids were great. They had a tremendous amount of focus. They really did a great job.
And it was not hot enough for ignition. I mean, it was proven.
It was not. It's just too difficult to wrangle that many people. Although Jamie, who was on the boat in a proximity suit, said that the light was incredibly blinding and distracting. And certainly he could imagine 2,500 years ago, a ship meeting that type of brightness from the shore might absolutely turn around and head back in the other direction.
Speaking about Jamie in a suit, I happen to tell you guys, those swimming suits that you put on when you did the swimming through the syrup.
Oh, God.
I mean, that should be on a fashion plate, you know.
Yes. We learned a long time ago that our dignity and good television are mutually exclusive.
Yeah, well, the thing about the, you know, being on the ship and noticing the lights, it points out that a lot of times these urban legends start with – they may go someplace that's crazy eventually that's totally, you know, not true or bustable. But somewhere at the beginning, usually there's some grain of truth. And we often only find that when we start to play around with these things. Like in that case, we were trying to set the boat on fire. That didn't work. But I noticed, well, maybe actually what started this myth was that, you know, maybe they actually tried to do this with, you know, flashing lights, but it wasn't to set the ship on fire. It was just to scare the invading hordes.
Was President Obama disappointed? I think he believed in the Archimedes myth, didn't he?
No, I don't think he was disappointed at all.
Well, it's good. You don't want to disappoint the president. Talking with the two Mythbusters who are here with us in studio, and I thought maybe we'd hear a little bit of your work. This is an episode some of you may remember. The Mythbusters tested whether someone could escape from a sinking car. I think this is the one episode that Adam Savage's mother will not see.
She's not allowed to watch it.
Not allowed to watch. So what happens is they push open the door in time before running out of air. These are the kinds of things you see in James Bond movies and all the like. Adam volunteered himself, high valor, or at least he was lucky one chosen to sit in the sinking car. And here's a clip that starts with the car sinking into a giant pool of water. There's a diver with an oxygen tank on standby in the back seat in case Adam needs air. And you can hear the narrator describing the scene before we hear Adam's voice from inside the car.
The car is sinking on its own. The 700-pound fake engine is taking it down nose first, exactly as it would in a real situation.
So the water's up to my butt now. All right. Okay, it's coming past my waist. Now I can start to see under the water. Oh, my God, it's coming up under the windshield. Wow, I can feel the pressure. All right, I only have a couple more breaths here.
Adam's never this quiet. So what's going on down there? The water is leaking in from every open crevice in the car, and Adam is now fully under. He holds his breath, tugs on the door, pushes his whole weight against it, but nothing happens. Finally, he can't hold his breath any longer and signals for Jamie to pass in the regulator. When the pressure ultimately equalizes, he opens the door and swims to the surface.
Ah, a little primal scream there. And Jamie, you two work together and have a very good relationship. I hope you didn't have any hesitation about handing that over to him.
No, we worked especially well under pressure in those kinds of situations. It's something we've done now hundreds and hundreds of times.
It's funny that we'll be in a situation like that. And even though we have very different working styles and very different methodologies and very different ways, we prefer to think through problems. Under high-pressure situations like that, our brains run on almost parallel tracks that we really understand nearly without speaking exactly what's necessary to do. And this really comes out when we actually have to work underwater in scuba gear. We find it really easy to do.
Well, in looking over some of the Mythbusters episodes, I was struck by – I found myself wondering about the budget for some of these things that you do. I mean, especially some of the big explosions.
Well,
and even something like that, you know, you're taking a car and drowning it essentially.
Well, one of our strengths also is figuring out ways of doing things efficiently. A lot of times, like the best known one is when we had to blow up a full-sized airliner. And
Did we build an airline?
Well, no. We went to a scrapyard where, you know, these things get recycled for their aluminum at some point when they've passed their sell-by date. So we just sped up that process a little bit with explosives. And, you know, I think it worked. Our researchers, which are an important part of our team, figured out that a long time ago that, you know, a lot of times we would have to buy the item and then, you know, do our thing to it and sell it back. And so we did that, and it ended up, I think, the doing that with the airliner cost us like $3,000 or something, you know. So we love finding ways like that to cut corners.
Where do the premises come from? I know, for example, there's some things like liquid oxygen that you just won't do. yet you just seem to proliferate with so many ideas.
It comes from all over the place. We get a lot of myths on Twitter through our Twitter feeds. I'm Don't Try This on Twitter. Jamie No Tweet. we get emails. We get questions from fans, and even people walk up on the street. At this point, the show's been on so long that the fans really have a great idea about what is testable and what would make a good show. So a fairly large number of the suggestions we get are reasonable and go on our list.
Well, we'll get some, no doubt, today. In fact, I put it out to you listeners. If you've always wanted to find out about an urban legend, urban myth, or a myth that you thought should be tested, give you an opportunity to maybe feed into the Mythbusters, Adam Savage, and you can see Adam and Jamie Heineman both with us today at their live show, Mythbusters Behind the Myths Tour, which is on October 12th at 2 p.m. and 8 p.m. at the Orpheum Theater. And we should mention Jamie Heineman is also the owner of M5 Industries Special Effects Workshop, where the show is filmed. You can join us, and in fact, I invite you to do that. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786, so feel free to join us with any questions or comments or suggestions you might have. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org. I want to go to another episode here. This was the sound of Adam Savage emerging. Excuse me. We just did that. This is the Mythbusters testing the local legend that three prisoners escaped from Alcatraz back in 1962 using a triangular raft made of raincoats.
The FBI files say the escapees were aiming for Angel Island, but the Mythbusters will test their own theory that they were smart enough to use the outgoing tide to carry them to the Marin Headlands.
Here I go, Jimmy.
Okay, we're off.
Three, gentlemen. Here we are.
We're escaping!
Adam, Jamie, and Will are paddling across the tide. If they've miscalculated, the current will sweep them under the Golden Gate Bridge and out to sea. The raft is getting weaker. Every 10 minutes, they have to add more air. And the tidal rip is getting rougher. It seemed impossible, but the Mythbusters are almost there. Paddling a raincoat raft more than 3 miles across a rushing tide, making landfall just east of the Golden Gate Bridge.
We made it!
And that hoopla feeling at the end of this, which often comes. But sometimes you guys are really putting yourselves at serious risk. I mean, some of these things that you've done are really, wow.
I think that there's a perception that there's a serious risk because a lot of the stuff we do, people have significant phobias about, like being buried alive or sinking in a car full of water or paddling a barely floating boat across the bay at 2:30 in the morning. But we really strive to set up every one of our experiments so that pretty much anybody could do it. I mean, we're in reasonable shape, but we're not paragons of physical fitness. We don't want to conduct an experiment where we just barely get out of it. We have a vested interest in surviving. So we really, I think, set up quite safe experiments.
Yeah, it's a weird place to be in, though, because, you know, we are often messing around with dangerous things. It's sort of our stock and trade. So sooner or later, you figure your numbers up. And yet at the same time, you know, everything that we do, any close call that we have, all goes into this sort of library of understanding of what we can get away with and what we can't. And so we've become much, much safer over the years. So somehow there's those two kinds of ways of looking at it are balancing each other out. And we, you know, we're proud of the fact that, you know, neither us nor our crew have suffered any serious damage. You know, we've had a couple of broken fingers from handling the safety equipment.
A few stitches here and there.
Yeah, and that's about it. So,
well, most stuntmen have a lot worse, I think.
Yeah. Absolutely. Actually, when we've done real stuntman work, like jumping off buildings into airbags, that stuff – that taught me that I don't want to be a stuntman. That's incredible and difficult work that they do.
You become so identified, though, with explosions and, you know, dropping cars into water or going across water on a motorcycle or all kinds of things involving vehicles, you know, or explosions and everything. And yet, you know, when I went back and looked at some of the old Mythbusters things, like, well, there's that Shrek-inspired experiment with earwax. There's some things that have to do with human biology, including Son of a Gun, which was nicely described as genetic material. Can we talk about those? And where?
That was very fun. The Son of a Gun is a story in which it's a famous Civil War urban legend in which a soldier is shot through his testicle by a mini ball, a classic Civil War era round. And the same bullet then pierces the womb of a woman 50 feet away and supposedly impregnates her. And we actually conducted this experiment in just what Discovery felt was a family-friendly way, which was they were totally impressed by. But we were not allowed to say the word sperm during the entire experiment. We had to call it genetic legacy, I think, right?
Yeah, it's kind of bizarre, isn't it?
On Discovery Channel yet. Actually, there's an old urban legend about a woman. I think it's an urban legend. Maybe true. I don't know how you would test this, but a woman in a bathtub and, you know, there was some of that genetic material in there and suddenly became pregnant. Similar kind of.
Interesting.
Yeah, and swimming pools, I've heard of that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, the spermatozoa stay alive and they have their own motility and there it goes and so forth. There's also a lot of, you know, I started thinking about biology and some of the experiments. There are all these stories about somebody sleeping and putting their finger in water. And
we tried that.
Did you try that?
Yeah, we tried that at the San Francisco Sleep Center.
And what did you come up with?
Well, it didn't work.
It totally didn't work. It was actually we tried it with Jamie first, and it's really funny because Jamie doesn't sleep, it turns out. He just lies there, and it looks like he's sleeping, and the charts all look like he's sleeping, and his EEG looks like he's sleeping. And then the moment a single sound comes, he opens his eyes, and he's ready to go.
What about methane and flatulence? I mean, there's lots of urban legends about that.
Yeah, we've
done a whole episode on flatulence.
Yes, yeah, and there was one part of that that actually did that ever air?
It did. It did air as part of a compendium special. We again, this is another episode where we filmed the entire episode. We weren't allowed to say the word fart. We weren't even allowed to say my second favorite, which was Chanel number 2. But yeah, we finished that with me lighting a flatus on fire, which is a classic frat boy trick, but hadn't been caught on film and never been shown on television.
On high-speed camera.
On high-speed camera, no less. And just at that time, I think this is 2004, Discovery felt too nervous to put it on TV. So it sat on the in the archives for years. I think it only aired about 3 or 4 years ago.
We're talking with the Mythbusters, Jamie Heineman and Adam Savage here with us in studio. They're bearded, they're brainy, and they've got a taste for adventure. And you can join us. In fact, we welcome your phone calls and your emails. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website. And by the way, they're looking for suggestions. They're always looking for material, which we are too. You know, you can let us know about things that we could put on the air as a talk show. No explosives used or anything along those lines necessarily, but we're glad to hear your suggestions as well. And I'm sure Adam and Jamie would like to. You can go to our Facebook page. You can tweet us. Our Twitter handle's @KQED Forum. We'll hear from you when we return. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending this hour with Jamie Heineman and Adam Savage, the two Mythbuster hosts. There's a whole team of Mythbuster people. And we should mention, I talked about their resumes before. Actually, Adam's father worked on Sesame Street as a Muppeteer, so he learned behind the scenes.
No, I have to correct that. He was not a Muppeteer, never a Muppeteer. My father did animated interstitials for Sesame Street. He directed about 50 of them over the years.
See, give us the wrong date on your Orpheum appearance. These publicists, you have to trust them to a great extent. But you did artwork that's been actually displayed here in San Francisco and New York and Charleston. And,
absolutely.
You're a legal geek, I discovered. And Jamie Heineman, who, as I said, Hoosier graduate in Russian language and literature, kicked around a little Russian language before he went on, but also animal wrangler, robot builder, toy prototyper, and holder of patent number 6,458,008, remote control stabilization device. These are well-rounded guys. I said, they're polymaths. You know, I'm a dilettante, but these are polymaths. We're going to go to your calls here and do that and your emails and so forth, and feel free to join us. Before we do that, I thought we'd hear one more cut from a Mythbusters show, and this is when Adam and Jamie made a canoe out of duct tape. You heard that, right? They actually made a canoe out of duct tape, and then they paddled it out to sea. Let's hear the clip.
Remember, we're sitting there in a canoe made of duct tape.
Come on!
Paddling towards waves that are like 3 or 4 feet higher than the prow of our boat.
Whoa!
Yeah! That's what I'm talking about.
It was absolutely terrifying, but once we made it past, totally knew we had passed one of the worst hurdles we could, and the boat was going to be okay.
Want to talk about that episode?
That was from Duct Tape Island. We were escaping from a deserted island using only duct tape to survive, thrive, and eventually escape. And that was a 18-foot outrigger canoe that we built out of bamboo and duct tape in one day flat. And it absolutely survived the breakwaters. It was very seaworthy.
Yes.
And let me just, before I go to calls, go to some emails here. Can these guys talk about the incident with a cannonball? That seems like it could have ended their career. I'm curious to hear how they responded. Was this a cannonball went through a house right here in Livermore?
Absolutely. A couple of years ago, Cary Grant and Torrey were conducting an experiment, and a cannonball got through its backstop and bounced off of a hill at the Alameda County Sheriff's bomb range and flew a couple of thousand feet before bouncing through the house of a local, hitting the roof of another and going through the car window of a third. Luckily, nobody was hurt. And it was it was absolutely the thing that we fear most of all happening on the show, something going awry. And it changed our entire safety protocol for the entire production on down. It changed the way we conduct safety on a daily basis, if not even an hourly basis. We really took that as a wake-up call.
Yeah, anytime we have a close call like that, we pay very careful attention to it. And, you know, that's what keeps us safe.
Was that the closest call?
That absolutely was the closest call.
Yeah, and especially since it's one thing if we're putting ourselves at risk, but, you know,
It's quite another to put the public at risk.
Yeah, you know, we were horrified.
You wouldn't save yourself ahead of the public if you had to? But what did you do? What did you change after this happened?
Well, one of the things we changed is we normally have a safety meeting with our safety expert and the insurance company before a show. And then on the morning that we're about to conduct an experiment, we'll have a brief safety meeting. We now have a safety meeting every single day that we're out on location, letting the crew know and the experts and the people assembled know what the main dangers are, what to watch out for, where the hospitals are, what the protocols are. We also change what type of locations we do different experiments at. We had gotten comfortable at this specific location, perhaps too comfortable. And when you're shooting a cannonball, your exclusion range in terms of the range in which there's no people should be the farthest distance that cannonball can shoot. And that is absolutely what our protocol is now for firing things. If we're shooting a gun and it fires a mile, we want a mile of clear space behind where we're shooting.
Some emails. Another Jamie writes, Jamie and Adam, hello from Dublin. Thank you. And this, by the way, is emblematic of a lot of emails that are coming in. Thank you, thank you, thank you for your hard work, curiosity, and passion. My 10-year-old son is obsessed with your show. We have Mythbusters binges via Netflix. My son previously had zero interest in science prior to discovering your show. He now requests science books from the library, lists science as his favorite subject, regularly brings up your experiments in conversation. That must be very rewarding. You get a lot of parents who say that about the show, and that's great. But here's somebody who I think wants a job. Alex writes, great shows, both Forum and Mythbusters. Thank you. Do Jamie and Adam need any help? I'm a general contractor, love science, and would love to lend a hand.
Well, unfortunately, as it happens, we have a very low turnover on, both from a safety standpoint, most of all of our people are still safely working for us, as well as they don't tend to want to leave.
We've had many of our employees have been with us for 6 or 7 years, a couple for 9 or 10.
Show idea, is glass a liquid?
is Glass of Liquid. That is a great show idea. It is perhaps the least televisual idea I've heard in a while. And it turns out that that is a myth. We've had it on our list for a while. It has been something that, you know, when new studies come up, we take a look at them. And it's been proven that glass does not move like a liquid. That it can't be classified as that. Very different from the famous pitch experiment, in which black pitch has been dropping one drop about every 25 years for the last few decades.
Well, we got a critical comment on the web. I make a habit of reading critical comments because if they're reasonable and not litigious or whatever, they should be read.
We like them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Only Anne Lamott didn't like them. Here's a listener who writes, I long ago stopped watching Mythbusters. They went from being a show for adults to engaging in mindless clowning around for the kids. And so it's becoming like the Jackass show.
Well, that's – yes, we clown around. We like to think of it as – a way of, I don't know, keeping things from being too dry. And, you know, we draw people in because of the fun element and some of the clowning around. And then before they know what has happened, they've actually learned something.
Well,
it is a fine line to draw, though, like, you know, how much science you should have, how much of the clowning around. And
But it's totally
arguable.
It is, but I'll also dispute that the show has gotten less sciencey. I actually think that our narratives have gotten much more detailed and deep over the years. If anything, if you watch the early episodes, they're very simple and straightforward narratives. And now the narratives are much more like peeling the layers of an onion. We're more interested in the depth of the science. We've gotten much better at parsing and breaking down the experiments and our methodologies. So I dispute that the show has gotten more clowny and less sciencey.
Well, maybe it's to the show's benefit. I mean, in terms of growing audience and so forth, that you have become, I wouldn't necessarily use the word more clowny, but more entertaining.
Well, look, the explosions and the clowning around is also part of the way in which we trick people into sticking around and actually learning something. And it's one of the ways in which we keep things interesting for ourselves after 250 hours of television.
Here's Wayne, who writes, I love this crossover to San Francisco Bay Area iconic shows. Guys, when are you going to invite Michael to appear on your show? We'll have to think of an appropriate experiment.
Absolutely.
Yes.
All right. Let's go to our callers, and let's begin with a caller from San Jose. Amy, you're on.
Hi. I was calling to reiterate on the my 8-year-old daughter has become a science nut. And again, it's a, hey, Mommy, what if we send this idea to the Mythbusters? But her favorite is one of your more simple ones, which is, do you remember the elephant being scared of mice?
Oh, that's a good one.
That's one of our favorites as well.
That and the Bull in the China Shop, she loves those simple, you know, oh my gosh, it's a simple thing, but it works or doesn't.
You know, both of those are great examples of experiments in which we really thought we knew what was going to happen when we set out to do those experiments. We thought that the biggest problem with the elephant and mice were going to be that the elephants were going to step on the mice, and we probably couldn't show that on TV. We set up, Cary Grant and Tori set up the Bull in the China Shop thinking they were just going to be wrecking China and it was going to be hilarious. And it speaks well, I think, for our methodology that we actually got genuine results we didn't expect, that we stand by, that the elephant totally noticed the mouse and genuinely tiptoed around it, and the bulls turned out to have an incredible kinesthetic sense of their surroundings and danced up and down the aisles of delicate shelves filled with china and didn't tip over a darn thing.
But here again, you might have gotten an elephant that wasn't afraid of mice as opposed to an elephant that would be afraid of mice.
We tried it with three different elephants.
What genders were they?
This is a good question. We've also gotten a criticism that we used a white mouse, which are very rarely found in the wild, and perhaps the elephant is more afraid of albino mice.
Maybe the elephant just thought it was an experiment because it was a white mouse, right?
It's true.
Let me thank the caller, and we'll go to more of your calls here right away here. Adam, good morning.
Hi, good morning. Love the show. My kids love the show. We watch it all the time. Guys, I had the honor of meeting you guys. My oldest son was one of your mini doubles in your San Francisco show last year.
Oh, great.
And that was fantastic. But I had a question. I don't remember if I asked you then, so I'm going to ask it now. In the episode of the car sinking in the water, it occurred to me that one way to break the glass when the car sinks and the pressure equalizes was to take off the headrest. And I wonder if it would work using those metal rods on the back of the headrest to shatter the window. I've never had to try it, so I can't say that I know or don't know if it'll work, and I'm curious if you thought of it.
No, we didn't think about it.
Actually, no, we did test that.
When
we were doing the water tank test with the window in the water tank in the shop, we were trying my steel-toed boots, and we actually did pull the headrest out and use the tines and attempt to shatter the glass, and it didn't work against the water that was actually not effective.
Yeah, I also recall taking out one of my pocket tools, a multi-tool like a Leatherman, and just, you know, doing everything I could with the points with various things on the Leatherman, and was not able to break the glass at all with that.
What's different about the little devices you can buy and put in your glove box with a little metal tip? They're just a very sharp object that works better.
It has a small, very hard, sharp point. It doesn't take that much, but it has to, you know, it has to have that point.
Since that episode, by the way, I keep one of those in my glove compartment.
I do too, yes, since that episode as well.
Thank you, Adam, for the call. Good to hear from you. Where'd you come up with the idea to put a rocket on a surfboard?
That just seems like something that everyone should try at some point.
A lot of times,
I don't see them out in Ocean Beach too often with rockets. You know?
Yeah, well, a lot of times it's one of the joys of doing the show. Production discovery found out a long time ago that if we're having fun, it makes for good TV. And so there's rarely anything that's off limits as long as it's something we can do safely. So we take on things like, you know, I had an idea also to put square wheels on a truck to see what would happen. You know, it's not a myth. We sort of made it one, like the myth is that, if you drive fast enough on these square wheels, you'll get a smooth ride.
Which we found is actually the case, surprisingly.
And then the wheels and the brakes all fall off and you end up on the ground. But
all four brakes fell off in one shot.
Yeah.
Bring some more callers on. And Wayne, you're on, Wayne. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael, Adam, Jamie. It's such a joy to get a chance to speak to all of you today. Actually, you covered my I left a comment on your website about a crossover between the Forum Show and Mythbusters. But
why do you want to bring down their success?
I don't think that I would at all. It's like I remember you way back in my days as an undergrad at San Francisco State, as a matter of fact, Michael, and you gave me a very good grade.
Actually, my wife also took a class with Michael back in the
day. Did she get a good grade?
Yes, she did.
Well, and no doubt they were merited in both cases.
Hopefully so.
Not known to be an easy grader, yeah.
Oh, no, not at all. It's like my paper was on Annie Hall and psychoanalysis, really tough one to do. But I was also wondering whether or not there was any chance that your live show is going to be continued ad infinitum, or is going to be continuing beyond its current run?
Well, like we said, October 12th, we're coming to San Francisco. October 13th, we're heading to San Diego, and then we're going to announce it soon. We are currently planning a multi-city tour in the winter of this year. That should go up on tested.com, the actual dates, within the next week or so. And we're planning, I think, 30 cities over 5 weeks. We love doing this show. We love taking it out on the road. It's the closest we get to feeling like actual rock stars. So we're going to keep doing it.
Well, you have become rock stars, let's face it. And let me thank the caller. Greg asked this question, interesting question. He says, I work in oil refineries and was particularly interested in a show the Mythbusters did on steel-toe boots. Have they considered doing safety videos for industry?
We've been approached to do that, and I'm not sure why it hasn't actually happened.
No. But we also had the secretary in charge of OSHA come by the shop recently, and we, of course, had to pose for a picture with him, so we all stood in a kiddie pool and held power tools.
Well, you used to do commercials. I know both of you worked in commercials, and what about brand names? For example, there used to be an urban legend, you probably know this, about pouring Coke on a automobile.
Yeah, we tested that.
You did test
that.
Yeah. And what'd you find?
The phosphoric acid worked along with aluminum foil to polish chrome on the bumpers.
It did really good at polishing chrome. It did not dissolve the paint of the car.
Yeah.
It also didn't dissolve a tooth. That whole thing, a Coca-Cola will dissolve a tooth in 24 hours, no, totally not the case.
Also, Coca-Cola is supposed to, they used to say, have some cocaine in it. Now, I don't know, other than snorting Coke, how you would prove that one way or the other. But what you run into problems, though? I mean, if you have a product like that,
we do,
you
absolutely.
Have to get all kinds of approval, don't you?
We had to call it Cola Myths. We have to be very careful about how we do that. We did – when we busted the fingerprint scanners, we actually we went to great lengths to conceal the manufacturer of the fingerprint scanner, and even still they were very upset by our results in that we were able to foil a fingerprint scanner with a Xerox that we licked.
Yeah, it gets ridiculous from time to time, though. Like we did something – I can't even remember what MET was. We did something with Twinkies and had to refer to them as cream-filled pastries, you know. And everybody knows what they are. You know, they're unmistakable.
I don't remember what we did with Twinkies.
Yeah. You've done so many shows now. Yeah. Look, here's a vital question, though. Philip wants to know, Jamie, why the beret?
Why the braid? Well,
sombrero got kind of unwieldy.
Yeah, that's the standard refrain. You reach a certain age and your hair falls out, and you need something to protect your head. And so I got in the habit of doing that. I didn't like a baseball cap. It just sort of happened that way. It started way, way before MythBusters, though. It was in the Caribbean because I used to run a charter business. And I spent a lot of time.
Like I say, these resumes are just.
Well, I was in St. Thomas in the Caribbean, and every day out on the open ocean and clear skies and everything. And so I got a hold of a beret, and it was less likely to blow off than the baseball caps were, and I liked it. It was just my own personal sense of style, so
I stuck
with it.
Become your signature.
Yeah.
It may be mistaken for a Francophile, but it's a good signature. My father-in-law used to put on a beret when he took out the garbage. Say, ouais, la garbage. There's a listener who writes, I used to be a big fan, but I stopped watching as animals were increasingly being used in the experiments. Really turned me off. I love the show's concept. Just wish that animals were not being put at risk for the sake of entertainment.
Actually, we have never put an animal at risk for the sake of entertainment. I absolutely dispute that. We do use actual animal meat for experiments all the time, and we don't like wasting it. So let me just give an example. We used a pig in an experiment yesterday, a 40-pound pig. We were testing something to do with sunscreen. I can't tell you more than that. But I will tell you that Jamie took that 40-pound pig home, cleaned it, dressed it, cooked
it. You put a beret on it?
No beret on it, but our crew is going to eat it for lunch today. So we strive not to waste when we're experimenting, and we've gone so far as to have full refrigerator trucks for the pigs that we're using for experiments.
My wife is a little upset with this kind of behavior, though, because it's happened several times. You know, taking a full-size pig and putting it in the oven, leaving it sit there for 12 hours, you know, at about 250 in the whole house. You know, I thought it smelled good, but, you know.
This is the new PETA, right? People eating tasty animals.
Yes,
I'm sorry. Let me get
really
a caller on here. Joseph, join us. Hi.
Hello.
Hi, Joseph.
Hello. So, which experiment has given you the best results?
The best results?
Hmm.
That is I'll tell you, we did one years ago called Bullets Fired Up. And the myth is that if you shoot a gun into the air, the bullet will kill you when it comes down. And we set up we did a lot of research in this and found that the military had actually researched this way back in the 20s. They'd fired 500 rounds into the air, and they were able to find two. They had a very difficult time finding them when they came back down to the ground. We built a methodology where we fired 11 rounds into the air and found six, and they confirmed our bench experiments that bullets, when fired perfectly straight up, fall on their side and actually don't fall fast enough to kill you. And I felt really good about the fact that the results we came up with that were far better and more succinct and more informational than what the U.S. military had come up with.
Well, they need you. Obviously, the military needs you.
Well,
Jamie.
That being said, though, I have to say we're pretty ambivalent about the results that we get. The only bad results for us are results that are not definitive.
Exactly.
Because a lot of times we can't avoid. Sometimes we'll go into testing and the results are, well, maybe it's maybe not. We can't say that on TV. We have to say, you know, vested, plausible, or confirmed, and this is why. We can't, you know, we can't be kind of confusing about it. So those are the only bad results.
Let me thank Joseph. Joseph, thank you so much for your call. In fact, Griselda writes, my 9-year-old son, Joseph's son is roughly in that demographic, Carlos is your biggest fan, and he wants to know, what math do you have to learn to do all the stuff you do on the show?
I still don't know how to do long division. I have to use a calculator.
we use a lot of math, but I would say, you know, we're not doing differential equations.
We're not doing, when we have to do physics equations, we've actually consulted with genuine engineers. The basic math that we learned in high school is what Jamie and I use to figure out some of our methodology, some of our results. We also have statisticians we consult that help us crunch the numbers, physicists.
So like how many people are working for MythBusters, including, you know, the whole tech crew and so forth?
Well, we've got two locations here in San Francisco, and one has Cary Grant and Torrey in it with a pretty much a duplicate shop to the one we work in, my place, M5. And each of those facilities has about a dozen people working in it.
So, about 25 people in the city, yeah.
And you're listening to Forum. We're talking with the two Mythbusters, Adam Savage and Jamie Heineman. And this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, which, of course, we would like you to do, and we would in any way inspire you to do, simply go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And let me go to more calls here. Let me bring in a caller from Seattle. Doug, hi, you're on.
Hi. Yes, I have a question for you, Adam and Jamie. There's a scene in the movie Sahara. I don't know if you've seen that movie with Matthew McConaughey.
I have not.
There's a scene where they're driving through the desert, and they come across an older, run-down, kind of sandstone-like wall, and they take a gun, shoot an archway through it, and drive a car through it, and it makes it through, only damaging the hood ornament.
Hmm. That sounds awesome. That just made our list. That's a great suggestion.
Thank you for that suggestion. They're very pleased with it. So Kent wants to know, will our local dirty jobber Mike Rowe ever do crossover show?
Mike is a friend of ours, and we love Mike, and absolutely we should figure out a place to put him, to have him come on MythBusters. Dirty Jobs has always been a sister show to MythBusters. We've always considered that we could give Mike a really good dirty job or two.
Oh, yeah.
And Del wants to know, any plans for more Battle of the Sexes? Can you explain a little bit about that?
We've done a couple of episodes on Battle of the Sexes, things that myths about what men and women do better. We actually just wrapped shooting a show we call The Laws of Attraction, about what men and women find attractive about each other. We came up with a terrific methodology, which I was very pleased about, for testing whether gentlemen prefer blondes. I will not reveal the result, but it was very fun to test.
Think about doing something with pheromones. There are so many myths about pheromones.
Yeah, actually, that's one of the funnier things that we've done.
we did a pheromone test.
We did pheromone tests. And setting up a thing where you have, well, I think we had about 50 women that we had come in and smell our T-shirts after we had worked out.
We weren't wearing them at the time, but the results are one of our favorite and weirdest results we've ever gotten on the show. We actually debated for days about how to actually call the story because the results were so weird.
Well, give me a sense. I don't know the story.
They weren't definitive, but we had a spike in the data that could not be explained away, that we had to address, and we had to figure out a way to talk about the spike in the data because it's hilarious.
Did they try to embrace you or anything along
those
lines?
No, we didn't find that.
Nobody was amorous.
No.
Well, Tony is our next caller. Tony, join us. Hi.
Hey, guys. I'm a huge fan of the show. I used to work with a guy who was a FedEx driver, and he used to actually deliver stuff to you guys, and he let me borrow a DVD of nuclear explosion tests back in either the 40s or the 50s, and there was a manhole that was launched when an underground nuclear detonation went off, and they never found it, and the myth is that it was actually launched into outer space orbit. And I was wondering if there's any way that you could do a small-scale test to prove or disprove that.
Yeah, you could do it live at Yucca Flats, or
that one's been on our list for a long time, but it's one that the funny thing was that obviously we can't use full-size nuclear weapons and test them.
There are no more above-ground explosions.
Yeah, but when we started to do the math on what would be involved with a small-scale test. It's bizarre.
If you had a manhole cover that was the size of a dime, you would need to place something like 6,000 pounds of explosives 18 inches under that dime to equate a nuclear explosion. It's just not something that you could do.
Have you thought of talking to the young leader of North Korea? That Dennis Rodman could act as your advance man.
Yeah, I was thinking the other day that we could get a heck of a lot of press by tweeting, somebody just contacted us about using a real nuclear weapon on the show.
Thank you, Tony. Thank you. Ed is our next caller. Ed, hi.
Hi there. I'm Ed Clark from Antioch, California. I'm headed to the Reno Air Races right now. And one of my favorite movies of all time is the 1966 version of Flight of the Phoenix. And I'm kind of wondering if you can take a C-119 Skytruck and cannibalize it and make a flyable aircraft out of it.
I love that idea. We've got a few stories. That's the problem with that one for us. It's been on our list, is that it's a giant build, and trying to do it under those circumstances is quite difficult. There's another one about a guy who took a car in the desert and with only what he had in the car was able to turn the parts of the car into a drivable motorcycle in order to get out of the desert.
Yeah, one thing to keep in mind is that anything that you see us do on the show, we've done in about a work week.
Yeah,
because we have about a 2-week window total to shoot or to do the show, and so if we're building something, it takes about a week to build it, and then we have a week to shoot it. So there's only so much you can do in 5 working days on some of these things.
And let's keep reminding people: don't necessarily try these experiments at home. We're out of time. We got so many suggestions for you guys. I'll give them to you before you leave. Thank you so much for being with us. It's been a real pleasure.
It's our pleasure. We're so glad to be on the show.
Thanks for having us.
And Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Larberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Senior editor is Dan Zoll, and executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Our interns, Keelan Cronin, Nick Zabrowski, Victor Vallier, Angela Johnson, and Aaron Newport. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and the Bernard Osher Foundation, supporting higher education and the arts.